Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
That's my first conception, man. That's the way I thought it should go. And I still do. I mean, of course, it could stand much improvement. Most likely in another 25, maybe 50 years, some youngster will come along and take the style and really do something with it, you know?
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Rockin' the Suburbs. My name is Patrick Foster. On behalf of Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you to our podcast. We are a daily music podcast, weekdays, that is. And we come at you with a little dose of music, music history, 80s album madness, and much, much more. So thanks for tuning in to this episode. Today, we're going to have the first of three short episodes that I am calling A Brief History of Bebop. We're going back to the 1940s, and we're going to learn a little jazz history over the next 3 days. So I hope you are going to enjoy it. I had fun putting it together. And before we dive in, I want to mention that next week we're hoping to have a week of Bob Dylan Hall of Fame album episodes. So if anybody out there is interested and you haven't already gotten in touch, get in touch with us and let me know, because we'd love to include you if you have an album that you would like to induct. We've already got a couple in there, and we'd love to have some more. So we got a couple of people out there who've already volunteered, and we will continue to do that, and hopefully we'll get enough to do some episodes next week to bring you that. And, of course, keep your mind, eyes, and ears open as we roll into April for March new music. Whatever you listened to, collected, or heard last month, we'd love to hear about it this month. That's the way new music works. So, happy April to all. This is not an April Fool's Day episode. We're really going to learn about the history of bebop. So, let's dive in, shall we? I'm going to do this in three parts. The first part will be the history and overview of the music and the beginnings in New York City. And we'll end up with just a few of the first recordings that were made in the mid-1940s. Part two will be when the music broke out to a larger context and some of the milestone recordings that came with that. And part three will be where it went from there, beyond influences and historical context, based on today. So I'm happy to be able to put this together for you. So let's talk about bebop. What was bebop? The birth of bebop as a style of music can be considered, I think, in a broad sense, the beginning of modern jazz. It tossed aside the danceable elements of the small combo swing music, which was a minor revolution from the big band swing of bands like the Basie Orchestra or Duke Ellington or Fletcher Henderson or people like that who would play the big dances in hotels, hotel ballrooms and rooftops and things like that. And bebop placed an emphasis on improvisation and tempo, as well as technique and complex harmonies rather than singable melodies that the swing era relied on so much. So it wasn't something where you would readily be able to dance to it. Bebop also changed the role that the rhythm section played. Drummers carried the rhythm more on the ride cymbal and much less on the hi-hat. Hi-hat was more of a swing thing. And as I said, bebop was not intended for dancing. It enabled the musicians to play at faster tempos because of that. Bebop musicians explored advanced harmonies, complex syncopation, altered chords, intricate melodies, and asymmetrical phrasing. The classic bebop group was usually a small combo that had a saxophone, alto or tenor, trumpet, piano, bass, and drums, double bass, of course, stand-up bass. And typically, they would state the theme of the tune, and it would often be, at least at the beginning, a jazz standard, which they called the head. So they'd state the head theme at the beginning and the end of the piece, and in the middle, the meat of the sandwich or the peanut butter and jelly, depending on what you're eating, would be the improvisation off that main melody by often the saxophone, the piano, the drums occasionally, even the bass. So it was all kinds of different flights that these musicians would take. Complicated harmonic substitutions for more basic chords became one of the commonplace things about bebop. So instead of just playing a standard, they would take a higher note or a fifth or an altered chord and play it right where it would be, taking you out of your comfort zone and breaking the music into a new era, a new place, I should say. One of the seminal bebop figures was Charlie Parker, the saxophonist, and he described a breakthrough moment while playing the jazz standard Cherokee in 1942, and Parker said this, quote, "I've been getting bored with the stereotypical changes that were being used, and I kept thinking there's bound to be something else. Sometimes I could hear it, but I couldn't play it. One day I was working over Cherokee, and as I did, I found out that by using the higher intervals of a chord as a melody line and backing them with the appropriately related changes, I could play the thing I'd been hearing. It came alive." Bebop was considered quote-unquote musician's music, and it drove a wedge between old and new musicians and audiences and fans of jazz and critics, too. Older musicians, including Louis Armstrong, did not like bebop. They thought it sounded noisy and jittery and frantic and too fast. And the general jazz public, who thought music should be dancing, were disdainful of bebop as well. And bebop, interestingly enough, spawned a new kind of jazz fan. And I like the kind of fan I think that it spawned was what I like to call the chin-stroking audience member. Often me at a concert who's just sitting there, in his own intellectual flight, and digging it all. People who derive pleasure from intense, close listening and really got off on the subtle nuances that the improvising musicians were able to come up with. Just those little changes. You think of the famous story of the jazz fan who recorded just Charlie Parker's solos. You know, he would turn his tape recorder on just when Bird would take a solo and turn it off when he finished. And there's an intense archive, a collection of these out there that are kind of like, this Dead Sea Scrolls. Amazing stuff. As a result of all this, bebop became one of the biggest influences on all popular music in the last half century, arguably. So where did it all start? Well, it started in New York City, as so many musical movements have. Parker, Charlie, was a fan of the saxophone player in Count Basie's Kansas City Orchestra, Lester Young. And he had spent a lot of time watching Lester, listening to Lester, even playing, jamming with him on occasion, I believe. And he had come to New York by the early 1950s to work with an orchestra. Also there, working with another group, was Dizzy Gillespie, who was a trumpeter, and who in his spare time was experimenting with chord intervals that went beyond traditional jazz harmonies. Bassist Milt Hinton often joined Gillespie when he would jam at these sessions. And a big factor, I think, in the development of bebop was the fact that it sprung from informal sessions. The players involved were not working for money. They weren't on the job or playing for an audience. They weren't trying to entertain anybody or play dance music for anybody. And because of that, they were free to experiment with what pleased them and stimulated them intellectually, not worried about what the band leader was going to say or how the audience was going to react, and had no reason to worry about how it was accepted because it wasn't really played for anybody but themselves. Other key musicians around this time, guitarist Charlie Christian, was also in New York in the early 40s and contributed to bebop with his use of rhythmic phrasing. You would occasionally hear a guitar in bebop every now and then. Sometimes there'd be two saxophones. You might have a tenor and an alto in some recordings, but for the most part, it was the standard instrumentation of the small combo that I was talking about. Two of the key piano players were also on the scene, Bud Powell and Thelonious Monk. You may have heard of them. Among the drummers, Kenny Clark and Max Roach were key figures. All these younger musicians striving to break the music down, go beyond the jazz standards, and find the next thing is really what bebop was and how it got there, spawned so much stuff. And later, there was a young student at the Juilliard School of Music called Miles Davis who got involved with the bebop scene. But we'll talk about that in the episodes to come. These guys that I mentioned would get together at a place called Minton's Playhouse, where Monk and Clark were in the house band, or at another place called Monroe's Uptown House, where Max Roach was in the house band. So you had your drummers kind of set in these house bands, and people would go and play after hours or jam with the band. This formed the nucleus, the birth of bebop. And that's the story I'm telling you. I'm telling you it right now. So let's hear a few tracks. What is often considered the first bebop recording was done on February 16th, 1944, under the auspice of a Coleman Hawkins session, led by Hulk Coleman and featuring Dizzy Gillespie and Don Byas, and a rhythm section consisting of Clyde Hart on piano, Oscar Pettiford on bass, and Max Roach on drums. And the song they cut was called Woody and You. Elements that we were talking about that comprised bebop in that sense. Several months later, actually about 8 months later, on September 15th, 1944 in New York City, Charlie Parker and Clyde Hart were recorded in a quintet led by guitarist Tiny Grimes for the Savoy label. And let's hear a little bit of that session, shall we? Here's one that I particularly like, not only the title, but the tune itself and the performance. The song is called Romance Without Finance, early bebop recording from 1944.
Romance without finance is a nuisance.
But definitely.
Baby, you know I need me some gold. Romance without finance just don't make sense.
It sure don't.
Mama, mama, please give up that gold. You so great and you so fine. You ain't got no money, you can't be mine. It ain't no joke to be stone broke. Baby, you know I ain't lying when I say romance without finance is a nuisance.
You're not kidding, brother.
Please, please, baby, give me some gold. Thank you.
All right, and as I said at the beginning, this is a brief history of bebop. So I hope I've given you the introduction, the overview of what bebop was, an evolution from swing music and small combo swing bands to a more inward-facing musician's music made by people who wanted to change the way jazz was heard, and they did that by using standards but twisting them, replacing them with different things, chords, improvising on them, taking flight with solos, and playing at a fast tempo together, inward-facing, as I said. Pleasure for the musician and the intense chin stroker out there. And that was a big, big change in the history of jazz. Tomorrow we'll get into how this music evolved, how it burst onto a wider scene, how it got more recognition and began to get accepted, and talk about some of the key records that were made in that phase of it. So I hope you enjoyed this, and I hope you'll listen to that one too. We're going to go out now with a date from October 19th, 1944. So we've heard three recordings from 44 in this episode. This one features Thelonious Monk on piano, Edward Robinson on bass, and Denzel Best on the drums under the leadership, once again, of Coleman Hawkins on the saxophone. This song is called On the Bean. And with the bean, we'll give it to you, and we will talk to you guys about more bebop tomorrow. Happy April to all. This is not an April Fool's Day episode. We're really going to learn about the history of bebop.